We'll hear arguments next in General Telephone Company against Equal Employment Commission. Dickens, you may proceed whenever you're ready.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court, I'm James Dickens of the Card Title Firm in Seattle. We represent General Telephone, the petitioner herein. We have a very narrow procedural question before the Court. It's very simple. When the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission brings a class action under Section 706F1 of the Civil Rights Act, does it have to comply with Rule 23? And we believe it requires a very short answer, and that's yes.
Well, let me ask you this, if I may, Mr. Dickens. Why would the EEOC bring a class action? It's entitled to sue as a litigant. I would have thought it could have gotten virtually all the benefits of its litigant status as a litigant on behalf of the government without denominating its action a class action.
Your Honor, the government has not in the prayer or in the complaint said that it is a class action. But by the scope of the complaint and the relief they're requesting, we believe it's clear that it is a class action. They moved at the trial court level to bifurcate the issue of class liability from the issue of individual damages. We then moved to dismiss the class action aspects of the case, and they acknowledge that they're seeking relief for a class, and that's what they are. We believe just the way the statutory procedure is set up, they are seeking relief on behalf of an individual plus on behalf of the class.
Well, but by definition, there's no individual in the any conceivable class that the EEOC could represent other than itself, is there?
No, Your Honor, that's where we believe that what Congress has done in accordance with its power to supersede the federal rules in whole or in part, it's declared that the Commission is a properly suing party, and therefore, to that extent, they have superseded the requirement of Rule 23A that it be a member of the class. As a consequence, by statute, we believe and we contend that Congress has made the Commission a properly suing party under Rule 23. Having taken that step, they're a properly suing party. It's the same as the Court has held, for example, in Hunt versus the Washington State Apple Commission. Associations, state agencies, and so forth do have standing to bring suit on behalf of a class, even if technically they are not a member of the class.
Who are the other members of the class?
Your Honor, the other members of the class, that depends upon two things. First of all, we look to the charging parties. We have four charging parties here. They were four women employees at one facility out of 116 in one state out of five. Now,
and they're on the same class as the EEOC.
No, Your Honor, I didn't say that. There have been cases at the lower court.
Well, doesn't the class action theory require that they all have the same claim?
No, Your Honor, substantially
doesn't
similar.
Doesn't the class action require that all members of the class stand on the same footing?
Your Honor, yes, there's a typicality requirement.
Isn't that true?
Yes, Your Honor, there is.
Well, who is on the same level with EEOC?
Your Honor, first of all, the EEOC
is on the same level with EEOC?
Your Honor, the EEOC is not on a level by itself. It's on the level with the charging parties. That's our position, that the typicality requirement, you look to the charging parties. The EEOC.
Is that what Congress said when it authorized the EEOC to bring a suit on its own behalf, that it was to have the same status as the charging parties?
Your Honor, we believe that's correct, in the sense that it stands in their shoes.
Well, but is that what Congress said in the statute?
Well, Your Honor, the statute itself, as the Court is aware, doesn't refer to this one way or the other in the sense of is the standing the same or otherwise? There, as we only have, as we've had, and we talked, I know the courts talked about this earlier today, the congressional history kept referring to cease and desist approach versus court enforcement approach, and should we follow the normal rules of procedure?
Well, what about the traditional action that was in existence long before 72, enabling a wage and hour administrator to sue to enforce practices of employers contrary to the Wage and Hour Fair Labor Standards Act? Now, could he have brought a class action?
You know, I don't believe so, because I think you have to look to the unique phrasing of the statute. In that situation, you normally have authority on behalf of the administrator to bring and file suit on behalf of the government itself. And you usually have questions in what is the relief. We're not talking about the relief. We're talking about the procedure, a procedure which is solely triggered in each case by the individual charging party.
Well, what about the United States suing under the antitrust laws in a civil action to enjoin violations of the antitrust laws? Could it bring that as a class action?
Your Honor, the United States can bring an action in its own name for its own injury, but when it brings suit in a normal civil or criminal case, it doesn't usually bring suit on behalf of other private individuals who have been injured and seek to bind the defendant to those individuals if it wins, but not have them bound if it loses. That's a critical distinction, and that's what we have here. The government says, if you lose, employer, you're bound to the class, but if you win, they're not bound to you. And we're saying that in this case, we have the procedure either for a private litigant or for the government under Section 706F is you trigger with a private individual, you investigate, determination. The commission says either we will let you sue or we will sue. If the individual sues, the government admits.
I'm surprised, frankly, that you concede that the civil action authorized by Congress brought by the EEOC is analogous in any way to the Hunt versus Washington State apple growers, which are all private litigants.
No, Your Honor, in Hunt, that was a question of standing with regard to a state agency, the Washington State Apple Commission. And the question was the standing by it as a state agency to bring suit on behalf of various growers in the state.
Well, they were all members of the agency, were they not?
No, Your Honor. They had some effect to the extent that they helped select the people who were on the agency, but it was not a organization.
It was a quasi-public trade agency. It was a trade agency with legislative status, was it not?
I don't deny that. It was, and that was part of the approach, but the court did say, as Your Honor well is aware, having written the opinion, that it was a state agency and there was standing to bring suit on behalf of the group. We're not questioning the standing of the commission to bring suit. We're saying the commission can bring suit, and we're not questioning at this time. It's not a question as to the scope of what they can do. All we're saying is that when the commission brings suit and says, well, we'll bring it instead of you, charging party, and we know you'd have to comply with it, we want the same relief, we say they should comply with Rule 23 also.
Isn't it up to Congress to decide that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Congress gave them the right, didn't they?
We're not denying they have a right to sue.
And did they have to go further?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
Did they have to go further?
Yes, Your Honor, they did.
I didn't say did or did not.
No, I said, Your Honor, yes, they did. They would have had to go further to exempt the commission from Rule 23.
Why?
Because the general rule is that the rules apply to all civil actions unless otherwise exempted or unless clearly superseded by Congress. Rule 1 says it applies.
Well, clearly superseded by Congress.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Congress gave EEOC the right to bring this action on behalf of these people.
That's correct.
And it didn't say class action. You said it should have said pursuant to Rule 23?
No, Your Honor. I'm saying the opposite.
What do you think Congress should have said? Or do you say the Congress shouldn't have said anything? That Congress intended Rule 23 to apply?
Your Honor, I'm saying that if Congress did not intend Rule 23 to apply, they should have said so.
Why?
Because that's the general rule. This court and Congress have promulgated the federal rules. They've said in Rule 1...
Congress did it.
Yes, Your Honor, and this court has authority also under its power on the statute to assist too.
The Congress passed these... The jurisdiction of this court as well as the other federal courts is determined by guess who?
Well, it's determined by the Constitution, Your Honor.
Day by day, by whom?
By this court, Your Honor. And by Congress?
I thought Congress had that power.
Well, they do. Yes, they do.
I thought they had the power to decide what jurisdiction this court had.
Yes, they do.
And they say that the federal court shall have jurisdiction over actions by the EEOC.
We don't deny
on
that.
On behalf of people.
Yes.
Period. And that's what the federal government did. Now you say you have to add on to that Rule 23.
Your Honor, I'm saying that Rule 23 applies. They also did not mention...
Can the average citizen file a case who is a member of the class without making the class action?
If he only seeks individual relief, yes.
Well, that's what they're doing.
No, Your Honor, they're not. They're seeking class-wide relief. That's where we have the problem. If they only sought relief for the four charging parties, we have no problem. But they're seeking class-wide relief without the following of the general rules under Rule 23. Well, Your Honor, I respectfully disagree. The Act doesn't say that. It says that you have a right to file the action. If they file the action, the private party files the action, they want to make it a class action, Rule 23 applies. Let me just briefly give the Court a little flavor for the facts. We mentioned some of them just to make sure it's clear. We had four women employees at the Beaverton, Oregon facility file charges. That's one facility out of 116, and that's in one state out of five that General Telephone operates in. The Commission investigated, and then it concluded it wanted to file a broad-based action. And the action is as broad as possible. It mentions no specifics, no dates, no individuals, and requests injunction, affirmative action. It requests that people be made whole who are adversely affected, and request back pay. We're not, in this case, questioning the scope of relief that can be granted. All we're trying to do, quite frankly, is avoid litigating this case now and in the future and in the future. I would think there's no question the court, I am sure out of our way, does not want to try the case two or three times. But if the class is not bound by any decision that's reached, then they can relitigate. Furthermore, this court has continued to say, in talking about Title VII cases, two principles we contend are very applicable here. First of all, under Title VII, it's the courts that are the final authority on Title VII and how it's implemented. We agree. Secondly, this court said in Rodriguez that the adherence to Rule 23 is indispensable. The requirements of Rule 23. We agree. That's what we're trying to do. Now, here's what we have in this case, for example. I'll give the court, I think, a very concrete example of where, in this situation, the Commission is making decisions that Congress intended the courts to make. First of all, there's no question that because you allege something to be a class action, that does not make it a class action. We have good class action allegations and we have poor class actions. In this case, however, the Commission has usurped the authority of the court in the class certification area. By number one, it said, this is a class action. That's normally a determination the court makes. And number two, it said the scope of the class is this broad. Now, we contend that those were requirements that Congress intended the courts have in making that determination.
Do you contend that in addition to certification, there should be notice to all the class members?
Your Honor, I think that depends upon the type of class action that's certified, whether it's
Well, it's one in which they ask that the defendants make whole those persons adversely affected by unlawful employment practices.
Well, Your Honor, I think that notice of some type will have to be given. Now, whether it's an opt-in, opt-out, that depends upon how the court decides to approach it. It will probably would be an opt-out type of notice that a class action is pending and you may opt out if you do not desire to be bound. That's the normal situation, I believe, in this case. But I want to go back.
Settlement,
Your Honor, that's where we have a big problem, quite frankly, from... they say, let's settle. And I say, well, I can't settle with you. Some good plaintiff's lawyer is going to tell me, hey, that's a great settlement. Let's file a new action on behalf of these people that didn't settle. They're not bound.
Under the government's approach, what about settlement?
They're not bound, Your Honor. The class members aren't bound. We have a settlement. It doesn't bind the class members. It binds the employer. Once again, it's the same thing with a judgment. We're bound if we lose. We're bound if we settle. The class members, they can either take it or they can go their own merry way and either bring a separate action or whatever.
Well, what if the EEOC brings an action against your client simply seeking to enjoin practices in violation of the Civil Rights Act of 1964? Do you think they have to bring that as a class action?
You know, I think there's a distinction, not so much under 706, but there can be a distinction, a dichotomy between injunctive relief prospectively and the situation where you're seeking individual make-whole relief under 706. It's in the latter situation where you are seeking to give back pay, you're seeking a seniority spot or a slot. That's where I believe we should bind the class.
But what if they don't ask for a back pay? What if they simply ask for an injunction?
You know, if they come in and ask for an injunction, I probably not going to request to bind the class. Although if it's under 706, I think it should. Now, 707 appears to be more the situation where traditionally broad-ranging prospective injunctive relief under a pattern or practice cases come in.
And but there not it's intentional.
Pardon?
There it's required to be intentional, too, isn't it?
Yes. As the Court is probably aware, it's already heard one Title VII case today. There was a long debate in Congress in the year 1971 and 72 over how much authority to give the Commission. Congress decided that the provisions under 706 permitting individuals to file suit was not working as well as it wanted. So we had the two approaches. We had the cease and desist, which would have given them an awful lot of authority similar to the National Labor Relations Board. Now, in that case, the Commission would have received the charge, they would have investigated the charge, they would have adjudicated the charge, and they would have prosecuted the charge like the Board did. But the Congress didn't go for that. They said, no, you've got to follow the regular procedures. We're going to be fair to everybody. We're going to be fair to the defendants and the employers. We're going to be fair to the parties. Now, we believe that what we're requesting is fully in accord with what Congress intended in granting court enforcement power to the Commission. They didn't give it unlimited authority. They gave it the same authority under 706 as the private individuals.
Just on one point.
Yes, sir.
Could it be that at a later stage of this proceeding you could raise the same point, the class action point?
Raise the question of not being a class?
I mean, when it begins to hurt you.
Well, Your Honor, I can raise it, let's assume there's a subsequent lawsuit by a lot of employees.
Yeah, all right. Or someplace along in this one.
But, Your Honor, what happens in that case is that I'm going to have as many different decisions as I have district courts in our five states that litigated. One court may say, well, you're bound by the prior decision if you accept relief. One court may say, well, you're not bound. We may go a variety of different ways. We don't think that's what the court intended or what this court wants to do. We've gone through the various parts in the history. There's no question the courts have split on the matter. And like as I mentioned earlier, we believe that had Congress intended to exempt the Commission from Rule 23, it would have done so. It's clear that in the legislative history, Congress made two specific references and changes in two federal rules. It made a change in Rule 53 on special masters to ensure that they would be able to handle these cases. It made a change in Rule 65. What you get out of that, you're well aware that Congress knew about the federal rules and knew how to make exceptions. It didn't make a similar exception for the Commission under 706 for a class action. Now, it did talk about in several cases in the post-history and throughout the committee reports that the Commission is a properly suing party under Rule 23. You can bring a class action. We have all of that. Now, when you look at what the Commission can do under 706, it's the same as the private party. We're not seeking greater relief or anything else. The charge is triggered by a private individual, both cases. Investigation's the same, both cases. The conciliation's the same in both cases. The action is the same as the private party's, with the possible exception that the standing is broadened to include other unlawful practices discovered. I'm not questioning the standing as such. The relief is the same as under 706G in both of the situations. Now, when the private party instead brings a suit instead of the Commission, all members of the absent members of the class are bound. There's no dispute on that.
Mr. Dixon,
Dickens, let me just ask you a little bit about how you handle the language of Rule 23A that says that one or more members of a class may sue or be sued as representatives of the class. Is it your theory that not the EEOC, of course, is not a member of the class, but are that suing on behalf of charging parties who are like the representative plaintiffs? Is that your theory?
That's correct, Your Honor.
Then if that's true and your charging parties, say, are charging sex discrimination, say they're for female employees who claim there was discrimination on account of gender, say the commission in its investigation decided they wanted to broaden the case to include some race discrimination charges, could they do so?
Your Honor, they could if they discovered race discrimination charges during their investigation, in addition to
right.
sex, as part of that investigation under the lower court decisions. This court has never ruled upon that.
But then with the charging parties, if you look at it as the members of the class in the meaning of the rule, as the charging parties, could they represent the victims of race discrimination when their charge had been based on gender discrimination?
No, Your Honor, what we're saying is this, is that as far as the typicality requirement is coextensive with the standing which the commission has to bring the suit. If they have standing to bring it on behalf of sex, fine. If they also have standing to bring it on behalf of race, fine. The question here isn't the standing. We recognize there are cases saying the commission may have broader standing than the individual charging parties. We aren't denying that. That's not an issue here. Whatever they have standing to bring, that determines the typicality.
No, but in answer to Mr. Justice Marshall, you in effect say, well, the rules apply.
That's
unless
correct.
Congress says they don't. But if you just read the rules, they wouldn't cover this double capacity kind of suit.
No,
the rule would really cover maybe a sex discrimination suit or any kind that would be an appropriate class for your charging parties.
Well, no, Your Honor, your typicality, then your reference is back to number one, the charging parties, and number two, the people who were not charging parties but who may have had claims that were discovered. It can be both groups. You may have to handle a case somewhat differently, but there's no problem. We have many class actions where you have different types of claims, or you may separate those. We're not contesting that. That's not a question. I wanted to reserve 10 minutes for rebuttal, and at this time would like to remain
there. Less than 10 left.
Fine.
So if you want to reserve it,
fine, we will.
Your terminal point.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Wallace, you have time to open at least.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the Court. Outside of the context of Title VII, no court has ever held that a suit by the United States or one of its agencies to enforce federal law must proceed as a class action on behalf of the affected members of the public. Even though there are many contexts in which such suits arise, and the contrary practice has been commonplace. We reviewed in some detail in our brief this court's decision in Porter against Warner Holding Company, which involved the rent control legislation of the World War II era. Back pay cases are common under the National Labor Relations Act. Actions to recover on behalf of an affected group of employees are common under the Fair Labor Standards Act.
They have express authority to do it, don't they?
Well, there's...
I mean, on behalf of named parties or unnamed parties?
There is statutory authority. That is correct. But at the...
Suppose there weren't. Suppose the United
States... Actually, there was not in Porter against Warner Holding Company.
Suppose there was only authority to bring suits on behalf of named parties.
There wasn't. Holding Company. That's what the argument was about. Our other order was construed by the majority to be such statutory authority.
Well, it wasn't express statutory authority to recover on behalf. It was interpreted
suppose
that way.
Suppose
there's a lot of emphasis on equitable power of a court to afford the relief.
Suppose the authority is only to, Mr. Wallace, to bring suit on behalf of named parties, of which there are certainly plenty of examples. Do you think the United States, under Rule 23, could nevertheless bring a class action?
Well, we haven't really faced that
you
question
should say
here.
No. You should say no. You should say that you're just You're really just exercising a strictly special statutory authority to bring...
There are situations where the United States represents individuals and is a lawyer for individuals. Under the Veterans Reemployment Law, or in cases where there is state taxation of servicemen. And I'm not sure that the United States could not move under Rule 23 in those circumstances.
You think it might then be a really representative under Rule 23?
I don't know. It really is functioning as counsel for named persons. It's not suing in its own name under those statutes. And when the cases have reached this court, the name of the United States is not a party. The United States is serving as counsel for individuals that it's authorized by statute to represent in court in those situations.
You're saying that the named parties are bringing a class action.
And in situations, for example, where we decide not to petition for certiorari, we typically notify them that they have the right to hire their own counsel and do so if they want to proceed with the case, even though we've determined that we won't go ahead with it. The case is really their case under those statutes. It's quite different. Yeah. From the kind of situation here where Congress has authorized the Commission or the Attorney General to sue in their own capacity to enforce the law.
Mr. Wallace, as I understand the petitioner's position, even if they grant you the right to bring the suit in the name of the EEOC, and even if you have the right to bring the suit in the name of the EEOC, on behalf of the four named complainants, you don't have the right to also ask for relief for a whole class.
Unless we can comply with and meet the standards of Rule 23, I believe that's their position.
And that's... What's wrong with it?
Well, that, I think most of that will have to await tomorrow.
Oh, okay.
But that's...
I just wanted to show you get there.
Yes.
We'll resume at 10 o'clock.
The Honorable Court is now adjourned until tomorrow at 10 o'clock.